My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
I'm very glad to be here tonight. I've said this before, but I should say it again, because people sometimes feel that I'm kind of an old cynical old guy or something, and bitter or nasty or cynical, and I'm not really. Down inside of me, I'm kind of a pussycat is what I am, and I was thinking again tonight, as I've thought before, if I had one day left to live, sometimes that happens, it's going to come to all of us, I think I'd come to Atlanta, I'd find Bill, and I'd chat with him, and listen to what he had to say, to make that last day seem like forever. I am very glad to be here tonight, and Bill was absolutely right about one thing. This is a stunning selection of speakers. I've heard all of them several times, and they're all excellent speakers. They're people who, as as Bill said tonight, live the way they talk, live the way they walk, you said. Jesus, you walk the way you talk. Anyway, maybe if you just loosened up that Santa hat a little bit. It should be a remarkable weekend. I'm certainly glad I'm here. You know, I'm sure there's young people in the room who don't exactly know why we make such a big fuss about the steps anyway. And maybe take 2 or 3 minutes to explain why. There seems to be two types of alcoholics. We never talk about it, but there seem to be two types of alcoholics in the world. There seems to be a type of alcoholic that drinks and has troubles and problems and creates situations. But something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a family, maybe they lose a job, maybe somebody dies in the family, and they quit! And they never drink again. My mother's uncle is one of those. I know several people like that now who can't understand why I just didn't quit the way they did. And they drank as badly as I did, as far as I can tell. And these same people are the same people for whom treatment centers were originally created. For those who had fallen into addiction to alcohol. Now, we talk about alcoholics as though it's an addiction. Physical addiction is a farther step. And there are many people who become physically addicted to alcohol. Many of the early AAs were that way. And you think about the sadness of drug addiction. Alcohol addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. When you withdraw from drugs, you get awfully sick. When you withdraw from alcohol addiction, you go into convulsions and smash your head in the sidewalk and have terrible times. And that's why these treatment centers were originally created to medically withdraw people who were physically addicted to alcohol and show them the nature of their problems and allow them to stop, and they would quit, and that'd be the end of it. In fact, up in Seattle, there's a very famous hospital called Chic Shadel that advertises, "We will cure your alcoholism in a month." And we think that's funny, but they do it. They have a long list of names of people they have physically withdrawn. That's one type of alcoholic. There's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by the way you measure them. They drink and have troubles and get bad situations. And something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job or a family or somebody dies. And they quit. But they always drink again. And they come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. I've learned my lesson, oh God. And they quit. But they always drink again. They've gotten the name to be of chronic alcoholics. And there's written records of them going back 4,000 years. People being just astonished by these people. You know, what's wrong with you? At one time they must be possessed by devils. They'd put them to death, stone them, send them away, lash them, imprison them, all sorts of things. And that went on for 4,000 years. And then, we got more enlightened, and medicine began to try to help them. Religion began to help them. But nothing ever helped them. They broke hearts. I don't suppose there's very many people in this room who hasn't had that experience of looking at someone who loves you and see that terrible look of disappointment in their eyes. Say, oh, how could you? You promised. And you were doing better. Now, why would you be like that? What's the answer to that? Leave me alone. Leave me alone, because there's no answer to it. And it's gone on like that for all these years, when I was a little boy up in northern Wisconsin growing up, there still was no answer to it. I mean, I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. But I, of course, I didn't know or didn't care there was no answer because I was not having any problem with it. But somehow, in 1935, some guy had a mental aberration of some sort in a hospital room in New York, and stopped him from drinking, and he thought he had some way to help people, and he loved, tried to love him and bring him to the Oxford group and teach him about Jesus, and nobody ever stayed sober. Then sometime later, it's an interesting thing, not in Jerusalem and not in New York and not in San Francisco or not in Chicago, not in Paris, in some little crappy hotel lobby in Akron, Ohio. A guy suddenly realized something he had never known before. He needed the alcoholic as badly as the alcoholic needed him. And then there was a change. And he and his first victim, Dr. Bob, realized they had to go to a hospital and call on somebody else. And they called on different people. And little by little, alcoholics of our type began to stay sober. When you stop and think about it, in 1931, or in 1930, there was a very wealthy family in New York. They had a son, Roland, who was he had bad nerves, because every time he got nervous, really bad nervous, he would get drunk and stay drunk. And they were trying to groom him to take over their big company. So they went to the best doctor in the world to ask for help. And they wrote to Dr. Freud. Dr. Freud refused to take the case, which is the first break we ever got. We'd all be sitting here and I'd say, I may be drunk, but I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his colleague and they sent their son to his colleague's hospital in Switzerland, and he worked with them every day for a year, apparently, until he had cleared up his problem. Sent him home, stopped in Paris for the wealthy family friends of theirs, had a big dinner in his honor, his recovery. They toasted him with a glass of wine, and 3 days later he was face down in his own vomit again, didn't know what had happened, and they were all just aghast. He hadn't got nervous this time, just got drunk. So they took him back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung refused to take him back into his hospital. And they go, gee, he didn't mean any harm, doctor. He's a nice guy. He just seemed to, something happened. I understand that. I misdiagnosed his case. He said, I thought he had a deep psychological problem that I could help him with. I see now that he is what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition in the world today at any cost. That was 1931, not long ago. Some of us were alive. And I can't remember what happened after that. But he came home and he went to the Oxford group and started the pamphlet, which we all understand the history of our group. But it's a funny thing. That's how serious it is. And the reason these steps are important in a way because of this little fact. These 12 steps, simple, innocuous, seem like some bastardized version of the 12 Ten Commandments. These 12 steps have changed the lives of more alcoholics of our type in the last 70 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is a miracle. And you're lucky to be here. You're lucky to be in this window, because if you'd been born many years earlier, you never would have had it. Your grandfather had very fortunate to find it, because at first there wasn't hardly any couple places you could go, New York and Akron and Chicago, and then a little meeting in Los Angeles, but nobody of any consequence would go to those things. And yet here we are today, and you know, our biggest enemy is to keep from taking it for granted. And yeah, I'm sober, so what? I had a bad day at work. Yeah, and that's why we're here this weekend with this distinguished group to discuss the steps. The only thing I think is a flaw in the program is on tomorrow night at 10 o'clock, they have the bill, the three wise men. Sandy and Tom and I I hope this doesn't mean we have to stand outside and look for a star. I am not here to take the role of Bill Roop and talk and talk and talk. I am here to... You're getting a lot of juice tonight, Bill. Juice is juice, no matter what it is. But one more thing I want to say. As a rule, when I go out and talk, some of you have heard me talk, and I have a tendency to evaluate and criticize my host for their errors. And tonight, I'm at a loss. Matt, the young man who introduced me, was at the right place at the right time in the airport today. Took me out to the curb where Tommy in the car wheeled up and picked me up. We drove off. I was all checked in the hotel. Matt carried my bags upstairs. But you forgot the key, didn't you, you dummy? Spoiled my whole trip. I believe the first and second step, I'm glad to talk on this subject because I believe those two steps, perhaps through the third step, have kept more people out of Alcoholics Anonymous than I know, anything I know. People like me, not people of any sense, but people like me. It kept me out of AA, I believe, for 10 years that I slipped in and out, in and out. And it always was the same. I went to my first day. I grew up in this little town in Wisconsin. I was raised in a very strict religion, the Norwegian Lutheran religion. And lived a very structured life. And I did very well. I was shoved ahead in school, and I was catechized and confirmed, and I got straight A's. Everything was perfect. And when I was about 11, my parents got a divorce. And it's hard to, at this time, day and age to think of this, but I had never heard of a divorce at the age of 11. There had never been any in our church or our family. But they explained it to me, and I began to understand what it was. But I exhibited the wrong streak within me already. I began using this divorce as an excuse to play my mother and father against each other and avoid structure and avoid discipline. My mother give me hell, I run to my dad and tell him stories about her. My dad give me hell, I run to my mother and tell her stories about him. And they both gave me hell, I run to my grandma. And I fooled them again and again and again and again and again. By the time I was 15, I was flunking out of school. I had become a sarcastic, nasty little snot. I had very few friends left of any merit. The kind of guys I was running with now were just a bunch of losers, failures. A couple of them wound up in the penitentiary. And I think I would have wound up there too because I was trying to outdo everybody and everything. But what saved my life was the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And that caught my attention. I used to couldn't wait for Sarah to get out of the newsreels and see what's going on. And a kid in our high school came back from somewhere. He had a Marine uniform on. It just looked wonderful. That's what I need. Because I was only about this tall and had a face full of pimples and glasses. And I was not a... Don't turn it off. I'm getting to the best part. Anyway. So one day I told my mother I want to go to Superior, Wisconsin, visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me a bus fare. I got a guy to give me a ride to Minneapolis, and I decided to hitchhike to San Francisco. I had no idea where the hell it was. I looked in the school library. I saw one blue state, a yellow state, and a green state, and then San Francisco. I was wanting to see a yellow state anyway, so I got a ride all the way, the first ride I got. I'd never hitchhiked before. Where are you going, kid? San Francisco? So am I. Hop in. Away we went. And took me to San Francisco, and I told him I wanted to be in the Marine Corps and kill Japs. And he said, no, you look too young. He said, but what you might do is get in the Merchant Marine. They're crying for people. They'll take almost anybody that's warm. So he took me to the Coast Guard office and said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. And he told me never to tell anybody I was 15, tell them I was 16. I want to be in the Merchant Marine. He said, fill this out. And I filled it up, put down 16. He said, well, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission, took the road back in. And away I went that afternoon to the South Pacific. It was really fun for about an hour. They're going to tail off a little bit. But on that ship, I was a young dummy. These guys were old, hard-bitten seamen. They were all, they'd been pirates any other generation. Ha, 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 ha. Drink and talk dirty. And I remember thinking, oh, yes, of course. They've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I was warned about. Something happened on that ship. These guys would drink whiskey at the end of a watch, and they all had whiskey they weren't supposed to have, but who's going to stop, you know? And they'd drink, and I'd lie in my bunk and just, oh, man. I mean, I'd been a sinner, but not like, these guys were sinners. They did dirty things. They talked every night about the dirty things they'd done with girls in San Francisco, and I just, I mean, I'd had sex, but I'd, you know, Clara, but I'd been apprehensive and afraid and alone. And these people, but one of the day, one of these guys turned to me and said, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort? And he shoved that bottle in my face. And I just said, I'm going to draw the line here. I may be over my head, but I was going to tell him, you get that bottle out of my face. I don't know if you know this, but I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran. We don't drink whiskey like that. I'd never been around whiskey. My mother and grandma told me never to drink whiskey, and I never will. So you keep that bottle away from me. I was just going to tell him that. He said, why do you think you're mad enough? I heard a voice say, God damn right. I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle I was ever close to, and I threw up, and they laughed at me, and it was a terrible, I was so ashamed, because they laughed. To this day, I don't know a worse feeling than public humiliation, when someone just makes you, they pull your covers, and they show what a nothing you are. I wanted to hit these guys. I couldn't. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. I'd have been thrown overboard, but it would have been a great victory. I could have leaned over you. Yeah. Take that. But all the way across the Pacific Ocean, no one was looking, I snuck in one of these guys' sea bag every day, take a drink of that whiskey, and throw it up, and have to wipe it up. But I was so determined. If I wouldn't throw up, they'd think I was a man. Nothing would have made them think I was a man, but I didn't know that. We were coming into Pearl Harbor, still see smoke coming up, and big, exciting things, and I'm down there taking a drink of whiskey, and I stayed down the night before my 16th birthday. Remember that? And I didn't throw up. And I discovered something. It made me feel better. It made me feel more like a man, as far as I can recall. I'm telling you a lot of details of things happened almost 70 years ago. How can I possibly remember them? I can't. But I have tapes from when I did. I started my drinking, and I didn't become a terrible drunk. And later I drank, tried to learn to drink like you try to control atomic energy. The next day they took me to Honolulu, got me 3 bottles of beer, and I got tiddly, and no big deal. But a little after that, I began to drink a little bit. I'd take a little drinks now and then that make me feel good and warm. And when I was 17, I went in the Navy. And there was the Naval Hospital for San Francisco being sewed together, and they passed around some tests. I must have been good on tests because I read all the time. I got very, very high. I remember the guy said, you're in the top percentile of 5% of the United States Navy.
Oh.
And what it did for me, it got me into college. I'm still a junior in high school. It got me into university after the war. I went to university and drank heavily, and I drank a lot in the Navy too, but I hadn't lost control. It just, alcohol to me was a great thing. I just loved alcohol. Most people, alcoholics I know, feel the same way. I remember sometimes telling some kids, alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go, lovers come and go, jobs come and go, cities come and go. But when a few drinks, you say, you just feel like Popeye. It's great. My only problem I ever had with it, I have a tendency to drink a little too much sometimes. Or later, in later years, my psychiatrist told me I have been thoughtlessly overserved. But I drank my way through college, won some trophies for the university, did very good. I was a big man on campus, chief justice of the court and everything. And through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was expelled a week before graduation. And I was supposed to teach journalism at Duluth Denfeld High School the next year. That was canceled, all of that, but I just had a terrible time. So I had to go find another line of work, and I became a sports writer, a newspaper. And then I was married and had my wife began. I'd married a Catholic girl because they seemed so mysterious. And she began doing what Catholics do that I didn't know about. She began grinding out those kids like boom, boom. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. So I had to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations. But in my senior year of college, I'd gotten to a point where someone suggested I go to AA, new thing in town. Okay. I said, why would I go there? Well, because you're getting bizarre and you're getting arrested and some of the old town drunks are slowing down even. So I went down there, eight guys sitting around a table, fat old guys. I said, what the hell are you doing here? I thought, that's kind of a funny introduction. I now know why they did that, because I was 22 and I looked younger. And nobody in that state was under 40 at that time in AA. You know, these old guys, like some kid 8 years old coming out saying, I think I'm an alcoholic. Well, do you? I think you have a broken nose. But they accepted me. It didn't take me long. It doesn't take anybody long to learn about AA. It's made up of alcoholics. What are alcoholics? People who drink too much alcohol. They come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol, which makes them feel better. Then they return to God, apparently, and they show their gratitude by helping others. It's just a wonderful place. But this first step, admit that you're having a problem with alcohol, implies that if you do that, you can't drink anymore. And I stopped drinking several times, but I noticed that my problem is not alcohol. My answer is alcohol. I got to find a way not to drink too much. And that is, you know, that is the universal thing here. If you're kind of new, sometimes read the first two pages of chapter 3. And that really is the best description of alcoholism on a continuing basis that I know of. It tells you what we have in common. Among what we have in common is we all have somewhere along the line had to accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. Just this obsession. There must be some way I can control it, because I'd want to do without it. And then it talks about things we have in common. We fight the term alcoholic. We have occasional brief recoveries. Isn't that? I've got them. I eat before I go out now. And then you learn you just puke more, that's all. I've tried different things, and I've tried. Then it goes on to say that we have all these arguments and fights and refuse to believe alcohol is a problem. And that one little sentence in there, God, I wish I'd have written that. That's a tasty little sentence. Reach a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I used to think, boy, that really is drunk when you get like that. But that's what that means at all. That means how you feel after you sober up. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I want an answer for your behavior. I don't know. And I went to A for a little while, but I tried to watch it after that. It didn't succeed very well, but I did. I got as I had more children, I had to get a job, better job. And I'm a fairly good writer, so I got a job in an advertising department of a major corporation, Fairbanks Morse. And try to watch my drinking, but drinking heavily. And one day, after a short time, they called me and said, you know, Clancy, you write very well, but we have to have you here on Mondays. We have work that day, too. He says, when you come in, you often smell bad and you're disheveled. I remembered, I thought, I'll just run a trial balloon. I said, gee, Mr. Collins, I think they've got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got drinking overseas. It was pretty bad over there. If you give me a two-week thing, I'll go down and go to join Alcoholics Anonymous and get cured. I said, okay, good idea. Now, one thing good about those days, you could go home and say to your wife, well, honey, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful. Wonderful. I know it'll help you, sweetheart. What do they want you to do? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been any rest for anybody anywhere, ever. Now they want you to taper up! They want you to stop entirely! We have the same steps, we have the same books you do! I release you, you son of a bitch! But that started a pattern for me of 10 years. So I realized I couldn't stop in 2 weeks. I couldn't get better because my problem wasn't alcohol. So I had to get another job. I did that again. All my children were born in different parts of the country. I'm going to start over again. I got a good resume. I got good samples. And this time it was going to be different. And it never was. And I went to AA, sat there, looked at that step, admit my problem is alcohol, and therefore my life is unmanageable. No, they don't understand that. My life's unmanageable, therefore I have to drink. It's a different thing entirely. These alcoholics can't stop. I can stop. I stop all the time. I can stop whenever I need to stop. My problem has never been that I can't stop drinking. My main problem is this. After I stop drinking, I feel pretty good for a little while. But then somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It comes out as just a little restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of the daily sermon of what I do when I drink. Get off it! It's over! Little by little, washing whatever I can see, perceive as technicolor in my life, slowly going back to gray, and the gray job, and the gray street, the gray people, and the gray, my gray life, but it's just, and when I was making money, I hated that, but I realized it was causing me a lot of problems. And I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find an answer to that problem, and I really gave the best I had, but nothing ever seemed to really work. You know what really works? And then you say, but I'll watch it this time. Oh. And again and again and again. And finally, it all blew up in my face. It must have held it together as long as I could. But finally, my wife was gone. My children were gone. They called me into my last place for a big firm called Tracy Locke in Dallas and said, you know, we had hopes for you, kid. You did a great job for a while. Give me the car keys. And you're out of here. You cost us a big account. And I remember he said something effective, I'm going to make it my business to see you never work in advertising again. That's kind of harsh. And I knew I had to get out of town because I was kind of through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. I was on probation from the state hospital, or parole. And all my wife ever had to do was pick up the phone and they'd come and get me. So I figured she probably had done that before she left. She's such a snot. And so I had to get out of town. A guy had asked me the week before, do you know anybody who wants to go drive my car to Los Angeles? I said, no. But that morning I did. And I said, I'll do it. He said, well, how about your big job? I said, oh, they're a bunch of phonies. I quit. And I took their car and I went to, first night I got to El Paso. I got drunk, had fun. Next day I got to Phoenix, got drunk. I didn't know anybody in Phoenix. So I thought I better hide the car. So I hid it. And I have never found it. All my clothes, all my ID, everything, money. I got, that night I was trying to find it, and some guy came by and said, will you help me find my car? I said, no, don't bother me. I said, come on, just don't. And he said, no, leave me alone. I said, come on, for Christ's sake. It turned out he's a plainclothes cop, of all things. And he threw me in jail overnight to cool me off. That's an ironic thing. Throw you in 130-degree jail to cool off. You don't really cool off a lot. And I In the middle of the night, I'm sick. Oh, God, I'm sick. I went over and threw up in the toilet. Turned out later, it wasn't a toilet. It was somebody's bunk. He wasn't in it, thank God. And I did, I'm sure most people do. I laid down on the floor. I put my cheek on the cool tile. God, doesn't that feel good? And go to sleep. And he came back from wherever he was and saw his bed full of vomit, this drunken fool right there. Get back! I'm sure he didn't mean to do it, but he kicked my front teeth out. That's one of the few mornings I was ever glad that I spent those thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. When I got out of there, I went up to the A Club and hustled some money off some old lady, and all I had my clothes covered with vomit and blood, and torn, and no front teeth, bleeding, and grabbed a bus to Los Angeles, and had some big adventures there with people. Some guy that I'd given a start to get me some money, and I spent it all. I wound up one morning waking up in an all-night theater. I don't know if you know, I've been to all-night theaters. They're on Skid Row. They don't really run all night. They run until 5 o'clock. And then they come in, wake everybody up, get all the bums out so they can clean it out, hose it out before tomorrow's act features. And it really is primarily designed for street people to sleep, because for 2 bits or 30 cents, you can sleep all night. And you hit the street, and you're so sick. Oh, God, I was sick. It was cold. I didn't know anybody at that time, except one guy, and he wouldn't talk to me. Some guy says, you want to sell a pint of blood? I said, yeah, I sure do. And we walked up the street to some blood bank, and we stood in line. And they took a drop of blood in my ear, so I didn't have enough iron in my blood to sell a pint of blood. I said, but God, what am I going to do? I'm so sick, I'm going to die. It's down here about 4 blocks, there's something called the Midnight Mission. Go down there and get breakfast. I go, all right. I went down there in the rain. And I said, I'd like some breakfast, please. And the guy said, God, you just missed it. You should have been here 20 minutes ago. We just stopped serving. I said, look, I'm really sick. I'm really sick. I got to have something. Please give me. He said, I told you, we're done serving. Come back at lunch. We'll give you lunch. I grabbed him by the lapel. I got to have everything. And two guys walked over, one detached me and threw me out the door. Don't come back, you son of a bitch. I tried to explain, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Serving Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And the one thing I had learned in the last few months when my drinking was really bad, is when you really get in bad shape, and smell bad, and look bad, and feel bad, there's one place you can go. Try to find an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. I said, some mooch, where's the AA club? He said, there's nothing downtown here. There's one on Wilshire and Fairfax. So I walked out there, it turned out to be 7.5 miles away in the rain. And I went in there, same old idiot, said, welcome, you're home, son. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, Jesus. Idiots. And I hung around there and to stay out of the rain, and they told me I'd have to go to the meetings or else I couldn't hang around there. And I went to the meetings and thought they were stupid, as usual. They talked about the staffs, and I had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. Tradition 3 says the requirement for members who desire to stop drinking. I had no desire to stop drinking whatsoever. To me, stopping drinking just brings on the horrors. That's all it brings on. Show me some way I can drink and not get in trouble. That's what I'm looking for. And I guess it's because the reason I stopped drinking, the reason I, with my sobriety, I fell into the hands of a man who, as the saying goes, talked louder than my head and explained to me what Alcoholics Anonymous was about and showed me where I was so terribly mistaken. I knew all about it. I've been going to meetings off and down all over the country for years. Listening to these people talk about it, I've heard people, and you know, you stop drinking, supposed to feel better. I never did. Turns out you're not supposed to feel better. And see, he was a very a very compulsive man. He had strong ideas about things. I remember one night, he'd pick me up sometimes to take me out to hear him talk. And read Brentwood one night, and some kid got up before he, the first speaker, and said, "Well, I'm sober 11 months, and I want to thank you all. I came here the first month I was sober, and my life kind of straightened out. I've been doing very well, and I came back to thank you for it. And I haven't been in any meetings because I guess I don't need meetings, but I'm doing very well, and I'm so pleased to be sober. Thank you." And after the meeting, old Bob pounced on him. Said, "Oh, you shouldn't even be around here. Take your face in here. You're the worst in our town." You know. On the way back, she drove me. I said, "Jesus, Bob, you know, why'd you jump on that guy?" She said, "Because he's got an alcohol problem." I said, "Bob, I hate to break this to you, but that's what AA is designed for, to help people with an alcohol problem." He said, "No, they're not. People with alcohol problems don't need AA." I said, "Well, what do they need, Bob?" "They need to stop drinking and clean up their act. And when they're offered a drink, say no, thank you." "That doesn't work. I've tried that a thousand times." "So that's because your problem isn't alcohol, kid. You got some, what I got, and apparently the people these meetings got around here." "I said, what's that, Bob?" "So it's something called alcoholism." I said, "Oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd believe." "Shut up," he said. And then he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But somewhere that harangue changed my life. When he got to the point, he says, "You know, I told you what the alcohol problem is. It's caused by alcohol. However, this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to make it so painful you can't stand it." I said, "Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that. They always say it's going to make you feel better." He said, "Nah, maybe for a little while, not much. Being sober is a terrible thing for an alcoholic of our type." Oh, my God, Bob. "Why do these alcoholics drink? If they know it's so bad for them, why do they drink?" I had already told him I wasn't really an alcoholic, so he knew that. I said, "Why do the alcoholics drink?" He said, "Oh, kid, you don't seem to know much for you, say, you've been around 8 or 10 years. He said, "You know what an alcoholic is?" I said, "Yes, I know." He said, "It's a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol." "Yes, I know, Bob. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. Then you drink, 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 drink." "Nah, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink," and he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, "If this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink." The effect would be almost instantly change my perception of reality. Soften it up. I have a couple drinks. Almost instantly alters my relationship to the people around me. "You with anyone, Granny?" "I take a few more drinks and I'm ready to fight anybody in the house." "Hey, don't say that to me. You call me a son of a bitch. You talking about my mother?" And I said, "Jesus, Baba. I didn't know that." He said, "Yeah." He said, "Alcoholics are people who get something special from drinking. Alcohol does something special for them, not to them. It does to them later. But for them, if it doesn't do it for you, it'll never do it to you. Because you quit." I said, "My God, Bob. I understand that. But there's always people who, I've been in bars where they drink the same as I do, and they go home." He said, "That's right. Because they're not getting the effect you're getting. They're not getting the effect. That's what makes an alcoholic of our type. It does something special for you." "And Jesus, Bob, it did something special for me. I said, but is that what makes my life unmanageable?" He said, "No. What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, if these people stop drinking, why do they drink again?" He said, "Well, they drink again if they don't do something about sobriety," or so I guess he said. I said, I don't follow you." He said, "Kid, when people are sober, the effect of reality on sobriety of people like us is it gradually gets gray and bad. and little by little you have to drink to stand it. He said, that's the nature of alcoholism is this. When we become sober, it's almost as though our sensitivities we wear them on our sleeve, and sooner or later someone hurts our feelings, or someone makes us feel bad, or someone rejects us, or someone does any one of a number of things that will enable me to have a drink to punish them. I said, my God, Bob, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I've had some big jobs, and I made some big money, and now I'm sleeping in the back seat of an abandoned car in the A-Club parking lot, taking crap from people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, because he was profane. I said, what could that be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, alcoholic? But I am kind of like an alcoholic, but I'm not really an alcoholic, Bob, because, you know, my problem really isn't alcohol. I said, that's right. An alcoholic is not a person whose problem is alcohol. An alcoholic is a person whose answer is alcohol. And if your answer is alcohol, it will become a problem and you will die from it. And he told me that in December of 1958. I guess I was sober 6 weeks or so. I was ready to go again. And I thought, maybe, what if I am an alcoholic? What if that first step means what it says? As he pointed out to me, he says, it doesn't ever say that your life is unmanageable because of alcohol. It says you have to admit your problem is alcohol. Then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Then you must also admit that sobriety is unmanageable. And if you didn't have both of them, you wouldn't be here. It's hard to remember that sometimes if you're new tonight. If both of those things weren't in your life, you wouldn't be here. If you could drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober comfortably, you wouldn't come to a meeting. When you can't do either, you get driven to rooms like this and sit there and watch your head tell you that your case is different and you don't belong here and these people are nuts. But you got to work through that phase. You have to get a sponsor. You know, a sponsor, the definition of a sponsor is to amuse the patient long enough for the program to work. And sometimes it's bad, you know, with sponsors, especially that first step, you know, because they tell you things that just don't make sense. Now, my sponsor never talked to me about the color of things, but he talked about things that's just, well, if he had said to me, see those boards there? They're brilliant red. Are you kidding, Bob? They're gray, for Christ's sake. I can see that. I tell you, they're red. Bob, they're gray. They're red! And you keep doing this crap, and one day you turn around, my God, they're red. Then you have to deal with idiots who think they're gray for the rest of your life. But it's a change of perception, a disease perception. But the first step is so simple, it's so simple to be down, and it means what it says, I can't understand why people can't accept it. And yet I almost died. I died once and brought back to life, could not accept it. All you have to admit, I'm having some trouble drinking. I'm having some trouble when I'm not drinking. That's the first step. It's just a qualification step. There's no deep meanings. What does it really mean? Let's go to the book study meeting tonight and find out. But the second step was really kind of weird because I had lost a son when I was in jail. He died, and I hated God for that. So I always knew he took my little boy who never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me because I was a sinner. That Norwegian Lutheran God does things like that. And so I wrote off God. I said, maybe you'll get me in hell, but you won't get me to land. Screw you, God. And that was the end of that. And I never stayed around. I'd go to meetings sometimes where they mentioned God, I'd just get up and noisily leave. I don't want to hear that crap. Now, here they want me to return to God. Bob said, try to work the steps. I said, I can't return to God, Bob. I just can't. He said, well, you're lucky. Nothing can ever ask you to return to God. Why don't you read what it says up there? You come to believe in something. Nothing in AA ever asks you to return to any old sick perception. It asks you to come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in a loving God? I said, no, I can't. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, "Congratulations, I'm your new higher power." And I knew he really wasn't, but I could accept that because I believed it. But if you're new, something else I try to remember when you're new, it asks you to come to believe that there's a power here. You don't even have to know what the power is. You just have to believe there's a power here. So I'll guarantee you, all these people didn't stay sober for years just so they could come here tonight and fool you. There's a power here. There's a power here. And you may want to find a power that is a loving power. But the funny thing in this step is this. Will do what? Restore me to sanity. I don't happen to be crazy. And I've known it ever since I left the insane asylum. You think that's funny? Are you mocking me? Yeah. Anyway, I had to come to understand what that was about, and over a period of time I discovered it. I have to come to believe, very simple. It's so hard to remember. These steps mean what they say. It can't work for people like me if they mean what they say, but it does. Come to believe that there's a power here that will do what? It will restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You could read 10 medical textbooks and get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is rather easy to define. But the human brain is under sufficient intense duress, can find no way out. It can find no alternative way to go. It's to maintain its neural integrity, it will set up a false perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And when you become psychotic, you stay psychotic. You don't in and out of psychotic. We have neurotic pains here and think we're going psychotic, but you're not. Psychosis is really a dreadful position. And if it's the whole wrong perception of the world around you, it's easy to spot and they put you away. But usually it's just a rifle, just some little area that needs to be triggered. I think about that a few years ago reading the paper about this guy. Said, I lived next door to this guy for 10 years. Nice guy. Came home from work at night, took a rifle, killed his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Why would he do that? Something triggered his psychosis. Psychosis is insanity. But here's an interesting thought. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that remarkable? We should be number one candidates for it with our variable emotions and our ups and downs. Why don't we become psychotic? Very simple reason. When alcoholics are people, if they feel bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol. And what does alcohol do? It alters his perception of reality. You and I have the ability, if we need to, induce temporary psychosis. Happy days, Jim. Then tomorrow you may go back to reality, but at least you got some relief today. So it seems to me that maybe what Alcoholics Anonymous is promising us in the second step is that I have to come to believe there's a power here that will make it unnecessary for me to drink alcohol, for me to induce temporary psychosis, to alter my perception, to enable me to live in continuing reality with its ups and downs without having to drink to stand it. It seems impossible. And yet it happens because this room is full of people for whom it has happened. Tom, they've been sober 50-odd years. Bill, they've been sober for 50-odd years. Really odd years for you, Bill. Don't ever talk back to the man who's got the mic. That's a mistake. They can't hear you, but I'll nail you. Love is the answer. I remember saying that to a guy one day, and he said, "What's the question? How do you get the clap?" I didn't say that. I wouldn't say that. But the first and second steps are very interesting. And all the ups are because they mean what they say. I have to somehow come to understand that alcohol, if it does what I want it to do, means that it's fatal for me. It will keep me going, and I'll die somewhere in a rented room, and they'll know I'm dead because after 3 days, the smell will start seeping out under the door. Or, as with that thing I told you, that maybe kneeling under with your arms tied behind you under an overpass because that time you screwed the wrong people and they shot you in the back of the head. And all sorts of ways to die. And even worse, staying alive sometimes. You know, it's an interesting thing. In the early 1960s, alcoholism was still kind of new in the general public, and people were interested in hearing about it. And the radio stations in Los Angeles would have people come down and talk about alcoholism and AA. And I went down a couple times. I was known as Alcoholic Al. And this one day, this guy was saying, "You mean to say, Al, that you parked your car in the garage and turned in the motor and died and had to be brought back to life to be put in the insane asylum?" I said, "Yes." I just said it. I wasn't surprised by it. He had big tears in his eyes. He said, "Al, you're the first person I've ever seen that's actually thought about suicide." And I'd been in AA too long by that time. I said, "Geez, you're the first person I ever met who didn't, you know, because of yourself." Suicide is always there as the final escape through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these two steps are, they really are absolutely essential for recovery, but they have nothing to do with your recovery. You will hear tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon and Sunday morning what you do if you can accept these two premises, that you can't drink and you can't stay sober. And there's a power here that will enable you to do that, even though you can't believe what it is. And you will hear for several hours people for whom it is operated tell you it can be done and reinforce you. You don't have to be new. We all have to be reinforced, it seems like, from time to time. We need to, no matter how fast our racer goes, we have to pull in those pits once in a while and get a little, check the tires. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is really such a remarkable thing. You know, 75 years now, it's been going for 75 years. And 75 years ago, there were two people sober. And they weren't in AA, they were just two guys trying to stay sober. And they called on a third guy. And the big difference was this. Bill Wilson had spent 6 months after he had his spiritual experience trying to help people. And not one person was helped. And he went down to the doctor and said, "Doctor, I don't know what it is. I can't seem to help people." He said, "Well, Bill, you're trying to teach them the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group's a religious organization. You're trying to tell them about Jesus. That never got anybody sober. What you have to tell them is that you know how they feel. And you understand their feelings and why they drink and what drinking. I can't tell them that because I don't know. But you can." And it turned out that later he had an offer of a job in Akron, and the first guy he had a chance to try it on was Dr. Bob Smith. And Dr. Bob Smith went to the meeting saying, "I will give him 10 minutes, Lois, or Ann, I'll give him 10 minutes, but I'm sick and tired of lectures about my drinking." They went to a room for 4 hours to him. I said, "My God, I've never had a person ever understand how I feel, why I drink." And they just got together and talked for 2 weeks about the Oxford Group and the varieties of religious experiences that could be found there, and the love of a savior. And Dr. Bob went off to the Medical Association Convention, got drunk, came back, and he realized sitting talking about spirituality was a wonderful thing, but that isn't what had kept Bill sober. But it kept him sober, who was trying to help people. So they went to the hospital. Got there to see another guy. This guy, I heard him talk years ago. He said, "I was laying in that hospital in Akron, Ohio. My wife said she wanted, two men want to talk to me about my drinking." And I said, "Absolutely not. I've had all the lectures about drinking I ever want to hear, and I don't want to hear any more. I don't even want to see these people. And don't forget that." I said, "But my wife's a strong woman." So I talked to those two fellas. And they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. I never heard anybody describe it like that. Amazing. He said, I became number three in the chain. And it was just think how hard it was with those early guys. Because there were no meetings. You took them to the Oxford Group, where they heard about religion for an hour. Because what the Oxford Group was a very nice organization of upper-class people, usually. And they'd get together once a week in someone's home and discuss spiritual values. And very nice people. And Bill Wilson had been bringing street drugs there to be cured, which made them worse than ever, you know. And but they were nice people. But that's where you had. I was at Bill Wilson's office in 1963 or thereabouts. I was in New York working on a project, and I went up to see him. They said, "Well, you can't see Bill. He's tied up for all day. Maybe next week." I said, "Okay." And I went off and went to the archives and nosed around. And all of a sudden, here comes Bill Wilson. He said, "Are you the young man wanting to see me?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in." So we talked, and you want to know what he said that was so important? I don't remember. I think I did most of the talking. I was so grateful. I was feeling great 5 years sober. But the one question I asked him, I said, "You know, Bill, we just had a book study. I was at the book study earlier this week, and you very specifically talk about how to talk to drunkards and how to talk to alcoholics, but you never once talk about taking them to meetings. Don't you people take them to meetings? In California, we take them to meetings, constantly meetings." He said, "Young man, when we were talking to those people, there weren't any meetings. We had to do it outside of me and just catch them and just nail them and try to get through. Because the curse of all alcoholics of our type seems like is that there's a wall that is written on it, but you don't understand. My case is different. And that difference is what kills people like you and me. And it does again and again. I see it happening every day around me. And the thing, it doesn't seem as though religion gets through that or medicine gets through that. It's just the experience of saying, I know how you feel. I had this happen to me. Maybe you do know, for God's sakes." That at least opens a little bit. But it's all been based on identification. That isn't just this interview with my subject today, but I'll say it anyway. That's why AA continues to flog this singleness of purpose. Because what Alcoholics Anonymous is today, and must always be if it's going to stay in this form, it is not wonderful people helping wonderful people. It boils down to this. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different at least enough so that he would begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, sobriety is conceived, and all we have to do is take the spark and blow on it and keep it going and find the wonderful recovery that we will hear about tomorrow and Sunday morning. And I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. Thank you.